From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Scholar and best-selling author Reza Aslan joins us in the hour ahead to talk about a long-neglected and undervalued literature, the literature of the modern Middle East. He's assembled a wide-ranging new anthology called Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. And he'll join us in studio for the hour, which will include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Reza Aslan is the author of Beyond Fundamentalism and No God But God, and the subtitle of that is The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. It has been translated into 13 languages. He's also contributing editor to The Daily Beast and associate professor of creative writing at University of California, Riverside, and editor of a new collection done in conjunction with Words Without Borders called Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. Organized chronologically and linguistically over the span of a century, the anthology provides a major portal into a literature that is too often neglected or ignored. The poems, short stories, novels, memoirs, and essays of writers of linguistic backgrounds that include Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and Urdu, with a number of works translated in the anthology for the first time. Reza Aslan joins us in studio for the second hour forum. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Delighted to have you back. And also congratulations. This is quite an achievement. 200 or so pieces, really literature reflecting history. And you're getting really, surprisingly, some extraordinary reception.
Yeah, it's funny. When the book first came out, a literary critic said something to the effect of, you can't get Americans to read American poetry. How are you going to get them to read poetry from the Middle East? But, you know, what one of the wonderful things about this book has been that people have been responding to it. It's been doing very well, and I'm happy to say that Americans are actually interested in learning more about this region and learning not just about the religion or the politics, the stuff that they see on the news, but really getting to the people themselves, finding out what they feel. You know, what are their aspirations? What are their hopes and ideas? And literature, particularly in a place like the Middle East, is really the only way to get to know the people of this region.
Of course, this is a broad, expansive notion of the Middle East. I think you prefer some other signifiers, don't you?
I do. Well, you know, I should say that one of the things that I've gotten a lot of pushback from let's say Turks, who say, why are Turkish literature in here? We're not really the Middle East. We're Europe. Or some South Asians who have said, why do you have Urdu literature in here? We're not really part of the Middle East. My definition of the Middle East came from the Orientalists. I use that quite deliberately because, of course, as you know, the very term Middle East is a hazy abstraction. It was a term that Europeans and colonialists used to define basically that middle land between Europe and Asia. And so I just kind of adopted that notion, and indeed adopted the very notion of the Orient as
– this is a Said notion.
This is that Said notion, exactly. The notion that the Orient and the way that it was used was to designate not a geographic designation but a moral and a cultural and civilizational designation. Basically, it's meant to indicate everything that's not Europe. So I said, fine, I'll use that definition, and so brought in North Africa and Central Asia, Iran, Turkey, South Asia, not because these parts of the world have, you know, very much in common with each other when it comes to culture or ethnicity or language or even religion, but because they do share a kind of historical consciousness, and their literature shares certain themes of identity formation and anti-imperialism that really creates a shared sense of literary history that I wanted to bring out and celebrate.
That anti-imperialism or anti-colonialism is a very strong motif throughout so many of these different cultures, but there's also a sense of establishing a national identity, as you suggested, and maybe even establishing a national identity against the kind of, well, in many instances, despotism or tyranny that is ruling the lives of these writers. A lot of these writers were really living under terribly despotic conditions.
Yeah, one of the great ironies of this book, as I kept reading and putting these writers together, is that so many of these writers, as you said, it starts in 1910, laid the intellectual groundwork for the independence movements of these countries. They really were at the forefront of pushing back against Western colonialism, creating the nation states that we know of today as the modern Middle East. But of course, very quickly, many of these writers, many of these poets discovered that the countries that they helped give birth to were sometimes worse than the countries that they helped shed off. And they became very quickly enemies of these new states. That's really, I think, a common theme throughout this work. See, if you're in a country or if you're in a part of the world like large parts of the Middle East where – for the most part, freedoms of speech, freedoms of the press are severely curtailed, if not downright forbidden. Then the poet, the writer becomes the journalist, the historian, the cultural critic, the political commentator. The poet becomes really the only voice of the people that you ever hear. They're the troublemakers. They're the revolutionaries.
Which the is unrecognized why so many... legislators, right?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
What Shelley called them. And
perfectly
in this case,
said.
This is certainly true for so many of these writers. And it's a liberating story in many ways. And it's a narrative that follows a whole trajectory. I mean, here you have an anthology, but you set it up pretty much as a narrative, didn't you?
This was probably my biggest goal when I first took on this project. My problem with anthologies, and I think a lot of people probably feel this way too, is that they're not meant to be read. They're meant to be tasted in these little bits and little bites here and there. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to create an anthology that you actually do read from beginning to end. And so I put these works together in such a way as to create precisely that master narrative that you're talking about. It does read as one sustained work. In some ways, I actually think of it as a new way of writing a history about the Middle East, except that instead of writing it through the words of scholars or academics or outsiders or conquerors and colonialists, it's being written through the words of the region's greatest poets and writers.
And here's a heroic thing I want to add as a major footnote, is that all the proceeds of this book go to Words Without Borders.
Yes, Words Without Borders is an amazing organization. I'm very proud to serve on its board. What we do is we take literature from all over the world in every language that you can imagine. We buy those rights with what little funds that we have, and we need more funds if you're out there and you want to give to a good not-for-profit organization. We translate those works into
English. In addition to KQED Radio.
In addition to KQED Radio, that's right. We translate those works into English. We put them on wordswithoutborders.org for English speakers all around the world to read. We provide education materials for young people around the country. I mean, look, if we're going to take seriously this notion that we need to be citizens of the globe in the 21st century, then we have to realize that part of that involves being familiar with the literature of the world. And, you know, a lot of us don't read Chinese. We don't read Arabic or Persian. And so what's wonderful about Words Without Borders is that it brings these works to us in a way that we can enjoy them.
A lot of us, in the manifold sense of us, don't read what's in our own canon or even outside of our own canon. And what's wonderful about this book is it brings attention to writers. I mean, some of them certainly known to us, but most of them not known. In fact, one of the writers found you on the internet, which is really quite an extraordinary story.
Yeah, this is really amazing. The work goes from 1910 to 2010, and as you can imagine, you know, some of the earlier writings, these are giants.
So you start with Cahil Gibran.
Exactly.
Lenny Bruce had a great line about Cahil Gibran. Do you know the line?
No, I don't.
Lenny Bruce as well. It's just that in the days, in the early days of, say, the 50s and 60s, when Cahil Gibran was really popular and everybody was getting the profit, he said, guys leave that by their bed just to impress girls, when to get them into bed, you know, but they're reading a sensitive, soulful poet. He didn't quite phrase it the way I did, but
you get
the idea.
In fact, you know, I just discovered that Khalil Gibran's book, The Prophet, which we all read when we were kids and carried around in our you know, back pockets, is the number one selling book of poems in the world.
More than Rod McEwen?
More than Rod McEwen, believe it or not. Well, so, you know, I did start, the book does start with the great Khalil Gibran, who, of course, is a giant. But I decided not to have one of his poems. I decided to have an essay that he wrote in 1913 because it's so indicative of, you know, the kind of work that was being done early on in the 20th century. And this notion that you can use language, that you can use literature as a means of forming a national identity, which was true for the Arabs, it was true for the Iranians, it was true for the South Asians, for Turks. Part of what it meant to be Turkish or Persian or Pakistani was to develop and revive a distinct language as a form of identity. And so there's this great section in the Khalil Gibran piece where he says it's what we need to do is we need to not just revive the Arabic language, but we need to be innovators and not imitators of the West. And if you don't mind, I'll just read this last section here. As for those who have devoted themselves to versifying and setting in prose their talents, to them I say, let your personal aims prevail over your attempts to follow the tracks of those who preceded you. For it is better for you and for the Arabic language to build a poor hut made of your humble selves than to erect a lofty palace made of your borrowed selves. Let your self-esteem prevent you from composing eulogies, elegies, and occasional poems, for it is better for you and for the Arabic language to die despised and cast out than to burn the incense of your hearts before the idols and the monuments. Let your national zeal spur you to depict the mysteries of pain and the miracles of joy that characterize life in the East, for it is better for you and for the Arabic language to adopt the simplest events in your surroundings and clothe them with the fabric of your imagination than to translate the most beautiful and the most respected of what the Westerners have written.
Yeah, there it is. It epitomizes, and not only in terms of that rejection of the West, but you point out that the 20th century Arab literary renaissance was all based on an attempt to get back to the common people, to the ordinary people, to what we could call the quotidian or the everyday, and the poor, of course, as well. And then there's this kind of fascinating parallel to that when we look at Persian and Iranian literature developing in the 20th century, because it follows along similar lines, more secular, of course, but pretty much similar lines. And again, the rejection of the West.
Very much so. Of course, you know, especially when you're talking about the 1950s, when Iran was really in thrall to the West, the Iranian Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah, had basically sold the country in bits and pieces to the British and to the Americans. There was this real sort of wave of anti-Westernism, anti-American in the literature of this period, even though some of the Shah's modernization and westernization ideals actually gave voice to new women writers, new forms of poetry, free verse, for instance, short stories. These writers very eagerly adopted the forms of Western literature.
Am I saying the name right? Usage? Y-U-S-I-J?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Iranian father of the short story.
That's right. The Iranian father of
the modern short story
of free verse, actually. Muhammad Ali Jalilzad was the man who really kind of was known as the father of the short story. But I was
that's the guy who wrote Once Upon a Time.
That's right. Yes. Once Upon a Time.
I was confusing them. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
But I was thinking more specifically of this incredible essayist by the name of Jalal al-Ahmad, who wrote perhaps one of the most influential anti-imperialist tracts ever written. In Persian, it's called Gharbzadegi. Every Iranian knows this work. And in American, it's translated as West Toxification. This notion that the West is actually a disease that infects the people of the Middle East. And his essay is in here. I'll just read very quickly the beginning introductory paragraph of this. I say that West toxification is like cholera. If this seems distasteful, I could say it's like heat stroke or frostbite. But no, it's at least as bad as sawflies in the wheat fields. Have you ever seen how they infest wheat? From within. There's a healthy skin in place, but it's only a skin, just like the shell of a cicada on a tree. In any case, we're talking about a disease that comes from without, fostered in an environment made for breeding diseases. Let's look for the characteristics of this disease, its cause or causes, and if possible, a cure. And he goes on from there.
Well, it's not that far a quantum leap to Khomeini talking about the great Satan, I guess, in some ways, is it?
And, you know, what's fascinating is that not just Jalal al-Ahmad, but most of his contemporaries were at the forefront of the revolution that brought down the Shah. They really created the intellectual foundations. They're the ones who pushed for democracy and modernization. modernism and really helped usher in the 79 revolution. But what they couldn't do is attach themselves to the poor, because the intellectualism that they represented was something beyond, I think, the literary and the intellectual prowess of the sort of poor masses. They were tuned in to the religious classes. So, you know, you have Khomeini and people like Ali Ahmad really on the same team, one a sort of secularist, a modernist pushing for democracy, one very much a theocrat, a religious person pushing for anti-imperialism, working together to bring down the Shah. But in the end, in the sort of the vacuum, the chaos that resulted at the end of that revolution, it was the intellectuals who were pushed aside because the poor masses flocked to the religious establishment. So again, as happened so often in this region, the people who helped spur revolution, who helped spur change.
And who are the subversives.
And who were the subversives and the revolutionaries themselves, when that revolution was over and the new state was formed, very quickly became the enemies of that new state.
I know that it's your desire in many respects. I'm not assuming an intention here, but I've read enough about you and your work and so forth to know that this is very important to you, to counter a lot of the stereotyping and a lot of particularly the terrorists from the Middle East stereotyping. Mm-hmm. I mean, here we get all of the intellectual ferment, we get the whole history, we get the sensibility, we get the culture, we get all of those things in a manifold way. And I was prompted to think, I'm just mentioning Khomeini. Khomeini wrote poetry.
That's right.
And then I was reminded of the fact that bin Laden wrote poetry, very bad poetry, by the way. And Saddam Hussein, when he was down in his hole, was caught writing a play of some kind. I mean, these were men who at least aspired to loving literature. And I wondered, these are the kind of writers here, to some extent, that they were influenced by.
Very much so. You know, this is a region of the world that is so deeply immersed in the power of language. You know, religious scholars will tell you that the Prophet Muhammad would often be asked by people, you know, to do some sort of miracle. Well, if you're a prophet, do something. You know, do something that like Moses would do, or do something like Jesus would do. Prove that you're a prophet by performing a miracle. And over again, he would say the same thing. The only miracle I have is the exquisite poetry that is the Quran. So from the very beginning, Muslim culture has been deeply immersed in the idea of the power of language, the notion of poetry as a means of expressing divinity. So it's not unusual that even people like bin Laden and Khomeini would, you know, be immersed in the poetic forms.
Isn't it almost de rigueur for imams to actually memorize the Quran word for word?
Yes, of course. That's a very common experience in a lot of Muslim cultures. Iranians like myself, of course, you know, there's this very famous saying that the great poet Hafez once said, that Arabic is learning, but Persian is sugar. And by which he meant that, you know, all Iranians speak in poetry. And so, you know, memorizing poems and being able to recite them at whim is sort of the hallmark of being Iranian. Very much the same is true of Turkish culture, of Pakistani culture, of Arab culture. This is a region in which literature is more than just stories. It's a vehicle for promoting a sense of self, a sense of identity, and even communion with the divine.
You were going to tell that story about the young man on the internet, but I just want to say that in addition to anonymous and unknown names like that, there are names that are known. Orhan Pamuk, in fact, who's been on this program, who was a Turkish Nobel Prize laureate, and Naguib Mahfouz, who is also a Nobel Prize, I think the only Nobel Prize, literary prize to be won by someone from the Arabic world.
That's right.
And you've got these great poets like Mahmoud Daoush, who is a great titan in the Palestinian world of poetry, Adonis, a Syrian poet who I think I saw Charlie Rose interviewing.
Yes, and today. And a perennial Nobel Literature Prize nominee.
He hasn't copped it yet.
But
I mean, these are the great figures, and they are. And I'm thinking to myself, they are relatively unknown in the West still to this day, including Panik. I mean, who's read widely throughout the world.
Yeah, it's a real shame, and I think it's a real testimony to the lack of sort of literary knowledge that a lot of Americans unfortunately have. These are titans. You're absolutely right. Many of them are titans. Many of them are internationally renowned winners of numerous international prizes in literature. Some of them in their own homes are treated almost like gods because of their, you know, their literary prowess. And yet in the English-speaking world, they are barely known, barely read. And that's something I really want to change, as well as, you say, you know, to overall just change the very way in which this region is understood. I said earlier, you know, most Americans only look at the Middle East through the lens of religion and politics. That's sort of – it's almost as though that's all the Middle East is known for. But if you're a person living in this region, religion and politics certainly plays a role in your life, but it's the arts that give you, you know, meaning. It's literature and music and
nurturing, it's sustaining you in so many instances.
Absolutely. It's the only voice you have. It's the only way that you can make your voice heard, because in most of these countries, the only voices that we ever hear are the voices of the powerful and the elite.
And some of this writing is really quite poignant and moving, and Reza Aslan's book brings to light the whole expanse of what he calls the Middle East here, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. Again, the title of the book is Tablet and Pen. Let's talk just for a moment about translation. I know it's one of actually poets I've always admired, Naomi Nye, a Palestinian poet, has done some translations here. And when you try to get some of this work translated, I mean, you have to have someone who can match at least an acumen or sensibility, the kind of poetry that they're dealing with. And that's pretty challenging. And it doesn't quite always translate. In fact, translations, you know, you hear people of native tongue always say, it's not really the same as reading. And it's true.
It's very true. Certainly, you know, when you're talking about some of these languages, you look at a language like Persian, which is a beautiful poetic language, and in which no matter how long the sentence is, the verb always is the last word in the sentence, which allows for some really fun ways of playing with the language if you're a poet. It allows for some great rhyming ability. And you're going to lose that when you translate it into English. That's for sure. But one of the wonderful things about working with Words Without Borders, and by the way, 77 translators worked on this book, is that we were able to not just find people who were literate and who could speak both languages and who could read in both languages, but we were able to find poets who could also translate from Arabic to English, or fiction writers who could translate from Persian to English. It was very important for us to have people who had a literary background themselves that were able to bring out the beauty and the sort of exquisiteness of the
language. How'd you find them all?
Well, so this is what our organization does, you know.
They Words Without Borders,
Yeah, Words Without Borders, you know, has been around for only a few years. But in those few years, as the only game in town, if you will, we've managed to kind of create a nice orbit around us.
I should mention, Reza Aslan also serves on the board of directors of Plowshares Fund, which gives grants for peace and security issues, Abraham's Vision, an interfaith peace organization, and Pen USA, which champions the rights of writers under siege around the world. And obviously a man of really stunning accomplishments, and has put together Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East, which has really been, selling lots of books, getting a lot of people out there, all the proceeds again going to Words Without Borders. We're coming up on a break, and we welcome your phone calls. Whether you're listening to us on radio, Sirius, satellite, or internet, feel free to join us. We will find about that young man in Iran who found Reza on the internet. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program with any questions or comments you might have. 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And Reza Aslan will be in Los Altos Hills at Foothill College in their speaking series coming up in December 1st to the 3rd, I guess. Huh?
That's right.
This is Forum. Your calls and emails when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Reza Aslan, and he has put together a pretty extraordinary anthology of writing from the Middle East, as he calls it, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East, called Tablet and Pen. And he's going to be spending the hour with us, and we're going to, in fact, go to your calls here in just a moment. I want to hear about that young man, though, because that's a story worth telling, huh?
Yeah, so, you know, the book covers the years from 1910 to 2010. And as you can imagine, you know, the earlier stuff was pretty easy to get your hands on. But some of the very contemporary work was difficult to find, and many of it was translated for the very first time. And the poet that actually ends the entire collection is this young poet in Iran, a kid really, named Ali Reza Behnam. Ali Reza is a, you know, poet eking out a living in Tehran. You know, trying his hardest to get his fellow Iranians to read his poetry. It's very politically charged poetry. And he was smart enough to actually put his poems on the internet, which is where I found them and had them translated into English and put into this book. And a few months ago, I actually heard from him. He found out about this, found my email and emailed me. And it was just such a really remarkable moment that this kid who, as I say, is barely eking out a living as a poet, like most poets around the world, even here in the United States, are in Iran. And thanks to, you know, globalization and to these new media technologies, had the opportunity to now have his poetry translated into English and read by thousands of people outside of his country.
Was it also read by the mullahs, though, who are looking for green revolutionaries?
Yeah, well, you know, somebody actually asked me, is there any way that any of these poems can be retranslated into Persian and then republished into Iran? Probably not a good idea. But I'll just read a little bit from his last poem in this book. It's called Hanging from the Trees of Babylon. And one of the things that's really amazing about contemporary Iranian poets is that they are really dealing with this almost sense of melancholy, a sense that you know, that their dreams, their aspirations, and their artistic endeavors are being you know, really denied and oppressed. And how to use literature, how to use language in order to fight back. This is Hanging from the Trees of Babylon by Ali Reza Behnam. At the end, I'll come down in my thousand years form, hanging from the towers of Cheganzabil, and there is something within me that throws language to the battlements of the tower. You will praise me, that's clear, in the form of an old man hanging from the trees of Babylon. Athens will rise within me, and Paris, and Persepolis, and many, many languages. Cut me to pieces. Every piece will come as a word, and will come as a word, and will encircle your eyes. Hooray is within me, and rising from the language beyond Pluto and Artemis's herd and rebellion of disobedient words, the whole are within me. And I, in my thousand years form, will be thrown from the virgins painted on temple walls to the shadows emerging from your computer, and being thrown is within me. Ask me about the future. I'll reply in Babylonian.
He goes back to Athens and Paris. How about that? We're getting Eurocentric again.
That's right.
I'm 1,000 years ahead of time, but that was powerful stuff. Let's go to our callers. Actually, before I do that, I have to ask you quickly about, as I said earlier, Reza's a contributing editor to The Daily Beast. In fact, a wonderful review of my book, which I'm quite grateful for. But also recently did an article. You're talking about Iran, where you hail from originally. And there's a whole thing about, well, Ahmadinejad's days being numbered that you did. And it starts off with a very funny joke about Shaheen Highway. Shaheen Ahmadinejad Highway. This is something, I guess, that goes on as an ongoing joke when you get in a cab.
Yeah.
Shaheen being a martyr because they're talking about Ahmadinejad like he's going to be history very soon. But you kind of feel that way. I mean, that's pretty much what you scope out.
Well, look, you know, Iran is so much more fractured than people actually think. You know, the bravado, I think, of Ahmadinejad gives people the impression that this is a very unified country. On the contrary, I think during the height of the Green Revolution, it allowed the conservative factions to kind of come together and push back against what they saw as a common enemy. But now that that has been more or less contained, at least for the moment, the conservatives are fighting amongst each other. And they're really attacking Ahmadinejad for his political reforms, for his economic reforms.
Weren't there 14 counts against him in the Iranian
right.
parliament?
And so the reports out of Iran were that last month, the parliament, which is dominated by conservatives, many of them former allies of Ahmadinejad, brought charges of impeachment for 14 counts of violating the law. And we're about to vote on those charges for impeachment when the Supreme Leader put a stop to it. Now, what's really fascinating about this is that rather than just simply let it go and move on, the parliamentarians have decided to go back and try to do another vote. And indeed, they need 74 signatures in order to bring impeachment to a vote in the parliament. By all accounts, they've got about 40 or so signatures. So it seems as though not even the Supreme Leader is able to put a lid on the growing dissatisfaction, even amongst the conservatives and the hardliners, to Ahmadinejad's reign. Now, whether that will ultimately lead to an impeachment remains to be seen. There is some reason to think that maybe even the Supreme Leader will allow Ahmadinejad to, you know, to throw him under the bus.
He allowed him to steal an election.
Well, he did, and in doing so, he sort of really made his bed with Ahmadinejad. But the more Ahmadinejad's popularity sinks, and it's sinking very, very low in Iran, the more the Supreme Leader may want to just simply cut his ties. And as I say, throw Ahmadinejad under the bus. We'll see. I think that Ahmadinejad is definitely going to try to do something with these new nuclear negotiations with the P5, the Security Council plus Germany. He needs desperately some kind of victory in the international realm in order to go back to his constituents and to say that he's, you know, working on doing something about the international isolation that Iran is facing, the economic hardships that Iran is facing. But even his own allies have lost confidence in him. And for many Iranians, as I say in the piece, they are taking bets to see how much longer he's going to last.
Another quick question, then we'll go to our callers and emails about another piece you did on Christians in Iraq. Again, terrible situation and not really being brought to light.
Yes, we know al-Qaeda in Iraq that are made up almost wholly of foreigners, non-Iraqis, have made a concerted effort to essentially ethnically cleanse all Christians out of Iraq. There have been a number of devastating, absolutely horrific attacks on Christian congregations, women, men, children. And although we've heard, you know, condemnation from the Iraqi government and condemnation from the U.S. State Department, there has really not been the kind of response that one needs when faced with what can only be described as a form of genocide. I mean, this is a deliberate attempt to get rid of every Christian living in a country that has had, in a part of the world that has had Christians for hundreds of years before Muslims showed up.
They were almost doing it to the Shiites in certain neighborhoods.
Precisely.
It's the same kind of thing.
Precisely. Well, whereas the Shiite make up 60% of Iraq, the Christians make up a very small minority, and their plight is being ignored. And it's something that I think is a real devastation. The State Department really needs to come out strongly against this. The Christian community in Iraq has been there for two millennia, and they have to be preserved.
Let's bring in our callers for Reza Aslan, and we begin, Tom, with you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael. Great show again. Thanks for taking my call. You know, a few months ago, Ahmadinejad he sounded like a crazy poet, actually, and you'd expect to be the leader of Iran to be the supreme poet laureate of the country. And he was, I don't know, maybe speaking metaphorically or poetically or whatever about the 9/11 incident. And he was saying that their intelligence showed that it was actually the United States that planned 9/11. And, you know, a lot of delegates, of course, walked out. I'm sure they weren't the poet laureate that Ahmadinejad obviously was. I mean, did anyone comment on his words at all as being poetry, metaphorical or fanciful or anything like that?
You know, that's a really good question. And there have been times in the past in which Ahmadinejad has said certain things that have not translated very well into English. Perhaps the most famous statement he ever made was when he said that the Zionist state, by which he meant Israel, must be wiped from the map. And everyone, of course, in the English-speaking world thought that he meant destroyed, because in America, in the English-speaking world, wiped from the map is a colloquialism for destruction. But it's not in Persian. It literally means that the borders have to be erased, by which he meant the land returned back to Palestine, back to the Palestinians, which is a far cry from, you know, physical destruction. But of course, that term has become very common. You can't, you know, no American, no surly, you know, pundit in the United States can say Ahmadinejad or Iran without mentioning that he wants to wipe Israel from the map, which is completely a false statement. Now, that said, the statement that he made about 9/11, there was no poetry in that. That's just one of Ahmadinejad's very famous red herrings. He's very, very good when he comes to the United States. He knows how to manipulate us.
And it's cunning,
he knows how to manipulate the media. He really
yeah.
does. He knows that he doesn't want to be asked about this economic situation in Iran. He doesn't want to be asked about the enormous setbacks in the nuclear program. He doesn't want to be asked about the impeachment process. He'd much rather be asked about the Holocaust. He'd much rather be asked about, you know, his statements about Israel, and he'd much rather be asked about these wild conspiracy theories about 9/11. And unfortunately, most of the media in
the
United
the
States, they take the meat.
It.
They just,
yep.
they indulge him.
Shireen joins us. Shireen, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for having Reza Aslan on the program. It sounds like a wonderful anthology. I was hoping to hear more about the women poets and writers featured in the work. You mentioned that you had made an effort to include, you know, a number of women poets and authors, and I'd love to hear you bring up a few examples of the women featured in the work.
Yes, thank you so much for asking about that, Shireen, because although it takes until about, you know, page 120 to get our first woman, the early part, you know, very much dominated by men. Once the women start writing, certainly in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, they quickly dominate the literary landscape of the modern Middle East. And nowhere is that more true, I think, than in Iran. Iran has given us some of the greatest poets of the region, none more famous, I think, than the great Farouk Farrokhzad, who's often referred to as the Sylvia Plath of Iran. I think she's far more than that.
She didn't put her head in an oven. We know.
No, but she died in a tragic
she was a martyr,
car accident.
Though. Yeah,
at a very, very young age, at the height of her literary prowess. She is really, I think, Iran's most famous poet. Again, unfortunately, someone that a lot of Americans don't know about. But her poems are in here, especially her very famous poem, Sin, translated by the Iranian-American poet Sholeh Wolpe. Farrokhzad really wrote about the internal lives of women, their sexual desires, their passionate desires, at a time in which women were given a lot of rights and privileges by the Shah, but in the cultural realm, still very much considered second-class citizens, still very much not given a voice. She says in this poem very famously, "I have sinned a rapturous sin in a warm, inflamed embrace, sinned in a pair of vindictive arms, arms violent and ablaze." And if you could imagine 1950 Iran, a young single woman writing that kind of poetry, quite scandalous.
Even 1950 America was a bit scandalous.
That's right.
Thank you, Shireen, for that call. And let me go to another caller. Wendy, join us. Hi, you're on.
Hi, Reza. I just wanted to start with a praise, which is thank you so much for your wonderful activism. I'm also an academic, and I have a course actually this semester entitled Introduction to Islam, and I have many of my students doing projects, various projects on how to combat Islamophobia. And I was curious, since you're also a teacher, you know, what your pedagogy is. You know, how do you, first of all, get students to take action based on what they learned in the classroom with you to kind of bring that out into society? If you encourage that, if you have various activities dedicated to that goal. And then I just have one last
thing. He's a creative writing teacher, not a community organizer.
But, you know, right, but I know what his, you know.
But he inspires activism, yes.
Yeah. And I just had one last comment, which is, you know, your reference to the first modern novelist. The first modern novelist is Jamalzadeh. And the first modern poet, actually, is, you know, that credit is attributed to Dehoda, which I'm sure you know who he is.
Yes.
And then also you mentioned that women are starting to write in the 40s. I don't know if that was, if I misunderstood, but, you know, there are definitely women poets, you know, throughout, you know, ever since the inception of Islam, but in particular, some really great 19th century women poets. And I'm wondering if that was just too much to include, or, you know, I don't know where your beginning point is, but I just also want to mention that.
Yeah, thank you for that, and thank you for the kind words. Of course, the book is concerned only in the 20th century, 1910 to 2010, and Parveen Etesami is the first poet that shows up in this. She shows up in about the early 1930s, an Iranian poet who really wrote about issues facing women that I think few Iranians, few Middle Easterners were thinking about. So women definitely play a very large role in this book, really from the beginning in the 1930s and 40s. You have the Urdu writer Isma Chughati, whose famous short story "The Quilt" about a lesbian love affair. Led to her arrest, actually, and a trial on indecency that she won in dramatic fashion. So the women here, very, very well presented. The question, I think, about the pedagogy, I think, is a really important one. And what I try to do over and over again, not just in my teaching, but in my writing and in my public work, is to break down the wall between academia and the world, the university and everywhere else. I think that there is this sense that sort of, you know, that academics, we spend so much time speaking with each other that we forget that there's actually a world out there that matters. And throughout my studies, throughout my teaching, I've always tried to break down that wall and to bring these ideas in an easily absorbable, easily digestible way to people all over the world, and to really sort of trust them to be able to absorb this kind of information and to act upon it. So I think it's really just – it's trusting your audience, trusting your students, giving them
trusting yourself,
that they need.
Too.
And trusting yourself, yeah. Exactly.
And I thank the caller. Let me go to some emails here. Let's see. Tim writes, I'm a huge fan of both yours and Professor Aslan's work. I would very much like to hear Professor Aslan's thoughts on the role that poetry and literature played in empowering artists in the political realm of the Islamic world's past, and what role modern poets are playing today in bridging the gap of cultural understanding today between West and East. What modern Islamic poets are at the top of his list of favorites? Thanks to both of you for another great discussion.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to say one very quick thing, because I think it's an important thing to understand, is that this is not an anthology of Muslim literature or literature from the Muslim world, not least because there's no such thing as a Muslim world, but also because many of the poets and writers collected here, even those who are Muslim, do not call themselves Muslim writers any more than, say, Philip Roth calls himself a Jewish writer. And indeed, there are Christian writers here. Khalil Gibran, of course, the person who starts it, is a Christian. There are Jewish writers in here. What binds them together is this landscape of the Middle East, not religion, not ethnicity, not culture. But the questioner is absolutely correct that literature in this region and in large parts of, you know, Muslim majority states becomes really a tool for, or let's just say, a mirror held up against society. You know, I said earlier that these poets sometimes become the only social critics, you know, that these societies have. That's very much true. You know, it's something that we've kind of lost a little bit in the United States. I mean, the great irony of living in a country in which we have such great freedoms of speech and freedoms of expression and freedoms of the press is that our literature tends to become very much inward looking.
In fact, a lot of the literature is, getting back to the last caller, pedagogical, or it's instructive. Horace said the purpose of literature is to please and instruct. And a lot of this, in fact, I was thinking that the Black Arts Movement, Latin American literature, a lot of these literatures break away from European, call it hegemonic aestheticism, because that's really what it is, and say, you know, we don't have to necessarily follow those kind of rules anymore. We can be as didactic, sermonist, homiletic, whatever you want to call it, as we want to.
And that's right.
And political.
Very much so. And you know, certainly politics is very much infused in a lot of these writings and a lot of these works. When you live in a society in which your voice tends to more or less be suppressed, it's impossible to avoid politics in the arts and in literature. And I truly believe that for Americans who really want to know this region better, that the only avenue that they have is the arts. You know, the arts provides this sort of universal language that allows us to break through the the walls that separate us as different cultures, as different religions, as different nationalities, and they allow us to get to know each other as human beings. They allow us to understand each other's aspirations and hopes, and to recognize that those aspirations, those hopes, those challenges, those fears are very much the same no matter where you live.
It's the universality of literature, and there's certainly a lot of it in this anthology. The anthology, again, is Tablet and Pen, put together by Reza Aslan, who is our guest. And it's funny, dovetailing with something you said before, why not translate some important Western literature into Persian so more Iranians can get access to some of the worthy ideas of the West?
Yeah. Well, so I have this dream. So there's going to be a British version of this book coming out. We got to get the Brits. You know, they got to be as much involved in this kind of literature as the North Americans are. And then I have this long-term dream about translating this work, which comes – it's translated into English from Arabic, Urdu, Turkish, and Persian back to Arabic, Urdu, Turkish, and Persian, so that Turks can read these great Arabic and Persian writers, so that Pakistanis can read the Turks and the Arabs, et cetera, et cetera. That's my dream. That's
what
I'm
working towards. Not an impossible dream. Here's another listener who writes what are your thoughts on the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami? Are you familiar with his work?
Very much so. Of course, he's a giant in Iranian film, perhaps the most celebrated of Iran's incredibly celebrated film
industry. But you don't
industry.
Work at all with that – I mean with the film genre here really.
Not in this book. No. Of course, I do very much I run a film production company called Boom Gen Studios. We work on creative content that's either from or about the Middle East. But you know, the point of that is that whether it's you're talking about film or whether you're talking about television or music or the fine arts or literature, this is a region that's teeming with the most exquisite, the most important artistic expressions that you could imagine. And you know, Americans of all stripes, regardless of what your politics is, regardless of how you view this region, have to be more aware of the art coming out of this region, because whether you like it or not, we're inextricably bound to this part of the world. And whether you see this world as an enemy, well, you need to know your enemy, right? Or whether you see this world as, you know, an ally, you need to know your ally. And the only way you're going to know them is through the arts.
I think you've just located why the book has had such a resounding success, because people want to know for whatever reasons. They really do. They're hungry to know, hungry to find out what more of our callers have to say. Ramin joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen, and it's so good to have this wonderful show. Now, my comment and question is that I found it very telling that the compilation that they have must be written in English, even though it's a global audience. But whether you were your audience was the Middle East, the only language that would be viable would be English. So my question is, what do you think is the effect of internet on the evolution of these languages? Would you think at some point in hundreds of years from now that they'll have to be merged into some form of English, basically?
That's an excellent question, and it's one that I have to say that linguists, you know, all over the world are struggling with. The internet, of course, has completely changed the world in so many ways, but one of the most profound ways is that the language of the internet is English, which means that throughout the world, people have to, if they want to take part in the world, the globalized world that the internet has fostered, have to learn English. And indeed, we're seeing even in places like the Middle East, blogs being written in English instead of in Arabic. Now, that said, I do think it's important to recognize that one of the largest, I think the top four or five largest languages on the internet happens to be Persian, and so you know there are pockets, and certainly Chinese, of course, has a very huge presence on the internet.
According to WikiLeaks, it was trying to make a larger presence.
That's exactly right. Yeah, to go back to that earlier discussion, but I do think that there is something very interesting going on in that you know, English has certainly become the quote unquote lingua franca of the world. and what that's going to do to literature, and what that's going to do to you know, these indigenous cultures, like you know, the Khalil Gibran said, you know, are people going to become imitators of the West, or are they going to continue to innovate in their own language? That remains to be seen, but it is a very interesting issue to talk about, no question.
Norm, join us, and thanks for waiting. You're on. Morning.
Hello?
Yeah, Norm, is that you?
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Quick, simple question based on my ignorance. You speak of Persian. I always thought in Iran they spoke Farsi. Are these one of the same things, or are these two different languages?
No, that's absolutely true. So Persian is the English word for Farsi. Farsi is the Persian word for Persian. They are the same word. Thank
Very
you for
that. Easy answer. Thank you. Yes. And let me get another caller on. Michael, that's you. Hi.
Hello, Ali Shaman Hubea. It's very nice to hear your discussion. I wanted to let you know that, fortunately, I was exposed to your culture through my former wife. My son's name is Siavash. His grandfather was a diplomat for the United Nations during the Shah's regime. And one thing I wanted to know was if you could elaborate on the era of Zoroaster and the ancient Sufis and the whole philosophy of the Ring of Fire and how that inspired their poetry.
Yeah, of course, Zoroastrianism is perhaps the oldest form of monotheism in the history of religions. Zarathustra probably lived sometime around the 12th century BC. And Zoroastrianism is, of course, an incredibly important religion. You know, the scholars like myself would say that there would be no such thing as what we call rabbinic Judaism or even Christianity, or for that matter, Islam, if it weren't for the teachings of Zarathustra. There are about 250,000 Zoroastrians left in Iran. There are actually many, many more Zoroastrians in India. They're known as the Parsis in India. Beautiful, ancient, wonderful religion, very much also deals with sort of the use of language and poetry. And Iranian religion, Iranian Islam, and certainly Shia Islam in general, still to this day has many, many elements of Zoroastrianism.
And also has many elements, since there are seconds left, the caller mentioned the Sufi influence and of Rumi's poetry continuing to have an extraordinary impact on modern Persian poetry, Iranian poetry.
Very much so. Sufi poetry is huge throughout the Middle East. Of course, in the United States, Rumi is the best-selling poet in America. Yes.
Even beats out Rilke or Emily Dickinson. Reza, thanks for being with us. Reza Aslan's book is Tablet and Pen. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.